You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Think of the 2010 Olympics as a big poker game. There are billions in the pot. Many players won a piece of it. They hope to walk away from the game tens of millions of dollars richer. Some of the participants are even playing with house money. But there are others who don't want to play. They've been forced into the game, and now they stand to lose everything. The Olympics is indeed about winners and losers, and not only on the field. Many individuals and corporations have become much richer thanks to the games, and many ordinary citizens much poorer. Am Jahal is a local social activist. He's also a member of the Impact on Community Coalition, IOCC. They're an Olympic watchdog group. Good morning, Am.
Good morning, Peter.
So financially speaking, who are the big winners as a result of the 2010 Games?
I think it's interesting to look at the Olympics as a kind of franchise that governments purchase every few years from Switzerland, and you pay a deposit and a fee on this with public money, and it results in skewed public policy decision-making. But as a result of the government investment and the government subsidy to these games, there are particular sectors that disproportionately benefit. And over the course of the games, the people who study these would argue that the tourism sector and the development and real estate sector particularly are the big winners in terms of the financing of the games, in terms of the distortion of the economic environment that occurs. Right after the games were awarded to Vancouver, the value of SRO hotels went from $500,000 to over $2.5 million. And there was a lot of real estate flipping that was going on in that type of speculative atmosphere. And so certainly people benefited. And some people might even remember during the bid process itself, Bob Rennie, a local real estate marketer, took out a full page ad in the Vancouver Sun on the yes side of the plebiscite. So from the basis of the amount of speculation that went on real estate, it was a great return on investment. If you take a look at the people who were pushing the bid, it was people from Tourism Vancouver. It was also developers like Jack Poole, who is chair of the Bid Corporation and now is on the organizing committee. And what I'd also point out is that there continues to be basically no civil society representation on the board of the Olympics, even though a great amount of public investment went in. Even though during the actual plebiscite process, much of the rhetoric was around a socially sustainable games. And when Jacques Rogge, the head of the International Olympic Committee, came in the spring, he praised Vanok and praised Vancouver for the putting together the first socially sustainable Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. So the extent to which it became a public relations enterprise, this idea of a socially sustainable games, didn't actually come through in practice in terms of the way we've been looking at it and acting as a watchdog. There was also a promise made to have a funded watchdog group early on, and that also didn't happen.
So what are the costs that we're looking at for the games?
They're still coming in right now, but the most kind of objective measures that are being put together are by the BC Auditor General, and they're coming out on an annual basis. But it is to the tune of several billion dollars. First, when people say the Olympic Games pay for themselves, that's incorrect. The cost of the infrastructure associated with the games, including the site facilities, all of that is paid for through public money. And if you add in the infrastructure around decision-making that is fast-tracked as a result of the games, which the Auditor General did look at. For example, the Sea to Sky Highway probably wasn't in the top 10 of public projects, but was fast-tracked due to the games. You throw in the RAV line and a few other infrastructure projects, including the Athletes Village, and which is now incidentally going over budget due to partially global economics and local distortions of economics to the tune of $100 million, which will probably have to be covered by the City of Vancouver. So we're looking at several billion dollars, and we really won't know the true extent until the games are over, because there's also the senior bureaucrats who are working on these games. There's Vanok, which is being funded, but also the secretariats of different levels of governments that are working full-time on the games. The actual three-week event itself does pay for itself from broadcast revenue, tickets revenue, and also the merchandising that they sell. But all of the actual physical nuts and bolts infrastructure was paid for by the public as a public policy decision in the absence of other things that it possibly could have been spent on.
So it's sounding to me like there's not much of a role, but where do the corporations come into this in play?
Corporations have become senior sponsors and donors, and some of that money is utilized to pay for the actual three-week event itself. But there is also a lot of benefit that happens. Large multinational sportswear companies utilize these games to launch new products into the public. So in the case of China, the big makers, Nike, Adidas, Reebok, many of them, which had sweatshop practices, according to the organization Playfair, which is Oxfam and a number of trade unions, have tried to raise these types of issues. And so as the games come closer, because of the spotlight around these games and the marketing potential, global marketing potential to these games, it's also a great opportunity to sell products. As well, it distorts the public sphere in a city as well, in the sense that the larger media companies who are official sponsors, in this case, Canwest Global and Bell Canada, both partial sponsors, end up causing a lack of critical journalism to be in place. And sure. I would cite the example of some of the work in the Vancouver Sun as incredibly uncritical in terms of looking at a broader sense of the coverage and the social impacts associated with the games.
But from what you're saying, it doesn't sound that the actual the corporations are actually contributing that much to the games, to the budget overall.
In relation to what the public investment is, I would absolutely agree with that. And because even their sponsorship investments that we see going in, there's great marketing potential for these companies, and they do get a return on investment as a result of it. Collectively, based on what each company gives, it does amount to a lot over time. What we've argued is, look, there's clearly social impacts associated with these games, especially on the lower end of the market. You know, there's a great body of social scientific literature that looks at expos and Olympics. And we said, look, if you put in a $1 homelessness levy on tickets, or you take a look at those areas of the economy which benefit disproportionately, such as the tourism sector, say we put on a $1 rental car tax in the period leading up to the games, or a $1 hotel tax, or a $1 levy on the actual merchandising, the toques and the sweaters that have Vanock logos on, and we create a social investment fund, that we create some type of social fund based on the economic turnover that's happening as a result of the games, that can deal with some of these impacts. And we were flatly told no, that this wasn't something that they would consider. In fact, the last time that I met with Vanock and with John Furlong was about a year ago, and it was a meeting that was unproductive. And in general, even though there's been a large amount of public money that's gone into these games, when we sit at the table as community groups trying to raise these issues, they are like a mining or a forestry company dealing with an Aboriginal or an environmental organization. And we don't have an equal seat at the table. And they wanted to sign public relations protocols and others that would have really undermined our independence as an organization. And so for the small amounts of input that we would have had, it simply would have undermined our ability to raise these issues in the public. And I think that's because the expectations were so high, because these games were supposed to be done much differently. Even for those of us who didn't oppose the games at the time, this project has been a total and abysmal failure.
So you mentioned that they're mainly business people on the committee, and no community representation is bound to skew things. Now, the real estate sector's profited pretty immensely from the result of the development of these games. How exactly have real estate companies and property developers been able to reap these sort of profits?
I think that the kind of irrational exuberance associated with market, once the games come in, that you're inviting the world, everybody's going to come here, that there's going to be international investment opportunities, all of this kind of works its way out. And we now have larger global ramifications happening, which impact on it. But certainly in those early days where we saw, you know, as I cited the example, the SRO hotels going from $500,000 to well over $2 million and resulting in evictions of those tenants. You know, some of these issues, because we have an inner city such as we do, we have a downtown peninsula that's already been built up, that with or without the Olympics, we would see development pressure going on to the inner city. What these games do, though, acting as a catalyst, is that they confirm and accelerate development paths beyond the direction that they would have been going, and so the impacts are much deeper. So we actually have to, in terms of public policy, go even further to prevent those evictions and those social impacts. And I think the lack of foresight at the senior kind of management levels of government is another area at its site. And I'd also say, because of the senior management role in putting these games together, we have a kind of institutional inertia and apparatus of senior bureaucrats putting forward pet projects. So in the case of the RCMP and other organizations and the integrated security units, we have the purchasing of new equipment. We have the expansion of private security cameras in the absence of any democratic deliberation over whether we need them or not. So because of the security implications of the 3 weeks, we may be left with millions of dollars of security cameras and the associated software to implement them, when we haven't even decided as a community, as a city, as citizens, whether we want them or not. Mm. And so the way these things are being fast-tracked without any kind of oversight, and they're having so quickly, it's kind of this fait accompli decision-making that's happening and being normalized in public. And also with an uncritical media in place, those of us who go out and raise these issues are delegitimized in the public sphere. So I've been involved in mainstream politics and public life my entire life in this city, and it's only when you begin to criticize the Olympics that stories are framed in a particular way, that you're written about in a particular way, that actually delegitimizes your ability to access the broader public in terms of what you're trying to say.
Wow, that's fascinating. So now it's sounding like a bit of a zero-sum game. What opportunities are there for activists to limit the damage?
I think that elections are one piece of it in terms of having a more favorable outlook in terms of how we're going to approach these games, in terms of mitigating the negative impacts, in terms of actually having leveraging these games for some positive elements. Because, you know, we have the activists have the great ability to shame governments with the truth, and I think that's a very powerful piece to have in your arsenal, simply because the games are about a year and a half away, there are opportunities to secure units of social housing, to secure policy changes around tenancy rights in particular. If they don't happen, there's going to be incredibly negative impacts in the city. And I think as we get closer and we get the spotlight of international media into the city, I think that there's going to be a big push to do some of these things. And it doesn't mean that the negative things aren't going to happen, but there is a bit of space to fast track some changes that would have needed to go forward anyway. And with the civic election coming up, with the provincial election coming up, it might not change things in particular on the ground, but at least it has the opportunity to highlight the issues a little bit more. I think also the grassroots organizing with Aboriginal groups, women's groups, and others, particularly in this neighborhood, are really exciting. And it'll be one of the first games where homelessness in Vancouver is going to be an international issue as a result of governments not acting on this issue. And we've had a doubling of homelessness since the Olympics were awarded to Vancouver. That says something about public spending priorities. And it didn't need to be this way. And it's because they shut out civil society organizations, citizens, from being around the table. And these games could be done differently, but they chose to use a cookie cutter approach. And they made the same mistakes as every other games have made.
Well, look, thanks very much for coming in. I really appreciate you coming in, because right since the very beginning of the bid in Vancouver, I know you've been very involved in this. And so I really appreciate you coming and taking the time this morning to talk with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
I've been talking with Amjo Hal. Amjo is a member of the IOCC, the Impact on Community Coalition, and they're an Olympic watchdog group. For more information on the IOCC and the Olympics, you can check out iocc.ca.